Okay, it looks like we might be almost ready to begin our next session. I'm not sure who we are. We seem to be missing a few people still. All right. Okay, so where we were, we're in our final session on RFP3, so we've really got to try and force things to come together in some way. Malcolm made a suggestion, and we seem to be converging around something. So I'm gonna make a stab here at really trying to push us to another level, if you like. Because ultimately, I think where the loop's got to close to is us seeing, well, how does this fit in with the straw man? Because if we came into this meeting yesterday with a straw man, and we went away from that, tried to do some work to better our understanding of what's required and what the specific functions are. And where I think we started to get to was an understanding that perhaps there's an echo. Is that this is this feels like this it is a little loud or okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I asked them to enable the microphone, so I gotta use my earphones. So there's volume controls on these things, turn them down.
Hello, hello. So we want to turn down all the hello, yeah, that helps.
This is Grace.
Yeah.
I'd also just like to note that if you guys have your Adobe Connect room open on your computer, one thing that you might want to do is mute your computer, because sometimes there's an echo with the Adobe Connect sound.
Yeah.
And
okay.
The microphone sound.
All right, that's better now. Thank you. So what it struck me is when we had a little dialogue here, which started to say, well, hang on, maybe there are we were trying to make one structure perform multiple tasks. So I took a step back, got into a huddle with the co-chair and the and Greg, who's worked on RFP3 on the straw man in a lot of detail, and tried to take what I'd learned from these sessions and say, right, what actual structures or functions need to be performed? And Marika's put that into a table for us now, and I'd like to just talk you through that and see if we have some kind of consensus around that. Okay, so that's going to have to be expanded, Marika. So if you can just okay, so yeah, that was okay, as it was. So this is a very rough draft here, but it starts to pick out what appear to be the functional structures we need. So the first functional structure, and these may not be perfectly formed words, but if you can view this as conceptual, and then we can perhaps refine it. The first one that needs to exist is some form of standing committee of IANA customers. And these are those that review the reports that Paul's made reference to, that are really made up of those entities that are customers of the IANA function. And this is your customer committee, if you like. those that review things on a month-by-month basis, and as we said, occasionally on an annual basis as well, and might have input into things like, well, certainly whether or not stats are being met, but also whether the right stats are on the chart and all of that kind of thing. The sort of thing where, so IANA has this direct relationship with its customer committee. The second thing that needs to happen is that in addition to that, that customer committee needs somewhere to escalate to, and that's what we had the dialogue about. If those reports, if it has persistent problems of either not meeting performance goals, that the right performance metrics aren't being responded to, it needs somewhere to escalate to. And that's when we go to the next layer down, which is this periodic review team. In addition, as being an escalation path for the standing committee, this periodic review team also needs to convene of its own accord periodically, whether that's every 1 year, 3 years, or 5 years, we can debate. But it needs to convene periodically. And that periodic review team feels to me like that's the significantly where there's a multi-stakeholder component, and that should probably be some form of standing committee, at least in terms of the participants. It may not be the actual individuals, but if you like, the definition of the seats at the table. And my analogy there is a little bit like something like the accountability and transparency review team. So it could be convened on a regular basis by standing arrangement, but it could also be convened on an ad hoc basis in response to escalation from the customer committee. So there's two ways in which it works. It either, let's say for argument's sake, meets every 3 years to say, is IANA performing properly, but also in response to an escalation from the standing committee. So we've then got two bodies, one significantly multi-stakeholder, one significantly customer, but with a direct relationship between them. There's a third entity, which is the Standing Policy Review Committee, and this is the one that deals with potentially, this is some sort of independent review panel. This is the one that deals with rogue delegations, somehow where the IANA function has performed in a way that it should not have according to policy. So we trust that IANA works according to policy and responds to policy, but what if it doesn't? What happens if it doesn't respond to a national policy, a national or a GNSO policy, or what happens if, where is the review that deals with simply IANA's response to policy or not? So that's in that bucket. And then finally, in the event that the periodic review team finds that there is systematic issues and seeks to change the contract, or in some way, so there has to be some other entity that has the contractual relationship. Now, this might be a very, very lightweight entity. It's simply a device to have the contract that's ultimately overseen by the periodic review team. But nevertheless, there is a need to have an entity that has a contract with ICANN in the same way as the NTIA has at the moment. So what we've attempted to do is get out of the weeds here and come up to the high level and say, do these four overarching functions feel like the right way where we've been getting to? So maybe I should pause there, and having given you that sketch picture, which is where it feels to the co-chairs and the team leads, the subgroup chairs, the co-chairs and subgroup chairs. This is an attempt to coalesce where all of that detailed discussion has got us to. So maybe I'll pause here and see reactions. Does this feel right? Because ultimately this then leads to lead back into and make sure we need to test this against. If you remember, we had the straw man in format that was empty elements. So in a way, we might want to pop these into the empty elements. Say, right, how's this picture starting to look now? Do we have the right functional entities and an understanding of what they should do in a post-NTIA world? Bernie.
Thank you, sir. Just for clarification, I like the description you gave of the independent review panel, but I'm uncertain the word policy appeals. We're not appealing the policy. We need a mechanism to appeal decisions based on policy.
I think one of the terms we used was policy issues. Well, it's really policy issues. It's when something takes place that is either a violation of policy or seems to be a ad hoc creation of policy that's at odds with policy.
Can we just give a moment for Marika to try and capture those words? And okay, so what we're looking at is a published document in PDF form, so she can't live edit it, but you'll attempt to. I think it would be probably helpful to do a little bit of editing as we react. So let's give you a moment to get technically set up for that. So I'm aware there's a queue. I'm just giving Marika a moment to get set up so we can edit as we respond and react. Let me clarify. There's a question from Desiree in the chat about standing committee. And let me clarify what we thought we meant by standing committee. I think standing has a general meaning in that it's always there. Certainly as far as I've lost the picture now for obvious reasons, but certainly as far as the periodic review group, the one that's over the customer group, the idea was if there was a standing component to that, the standing component were the seats at the table. For example, the GNSO, the CCNSO, not necessarily the individuals occupying those seats. So, for example, there's an escalation from the customer group that says, right, we have a problem. That committee convenes, and it is standing to the extent that it is already predefined who has a seat at the table, but it is not predefined, which GAC representative or representatives is at the table or which GNSO representatives. It may well be that it's the same year on year, but it's not necessarily. So in a similar way, which is why we made the analogy with the ATRT, it would be composed in that way, but you wouldn't expect necessarily ATRT1 to have exactly the same members as ATRT2. All right. Correct. Avery has a question. Seats are defined by not who occupies them, exactly. Correct. Seats are defined by not who occupies them, but by the group whose seat it is, if you like. So for argument's sake, there's two GNSO, two CCNSO, I don't want two GAC, whatever it is. That's what makes up that group's seats at the on the periodic review team. I don't have a picture in my mind currently what the policy implementation appeals review team would look like. Alan, I see your hand is up, but you are in the queue already, and I've got Donna and Sean ahead
That's
of you.
That's fine. I was just going to speak to
them. All right. So let's go to Donna now that the picture is up and live on the screen.
Thanks, Jonathan. Donna Austin. So I think this is useful, and it provides a little bit of clarity for me. I just wonder if we're missing something here in that we need an entity that needs to identify what the composition of the contract or whatever agreement looks like. And I think that's reasonably important because that's your starting point. So is it the intention that the IANA contracting entity is also potentially the entity that decides what the contract looks like, what components are in the contract.
I would say that's not necessarily the case. I think first we, try to flesh out the idea of the contracting entity is to make that entity as minimalist as possible, and that more likely it would be something more akin to the performance review team that would decide on the contents of the contract, and then the contracting entity would exist largely to be the counterparty to ICANN or the IANN provider, whoever that might be in the future.
Yeah, good point. So the thinking there is that it's not another duplication of a whole new sort of multi-stakeholder body type team. That actually it's a vehicle, as Greg said, to be the counterparty, but potentially supervised by the can't read what we've been calling the group in the box above there. The IANA, just scroll it down for me a little. The IANA Periodic Review Team. So, whilst the IANA Periodic Review Team might need to engage legal expertise and so on to assist with that, at the moment the contracting entity is not a whole new other multi-stakeholder body. There's a big queue. Let me clear off from the microphone and hear from others. Sean.
Thank you, Jonathan. This is Sean. I want to be clear about the independent standing policy appeal committee. So is it going to be in the format of the different, for instance, for the GTLD, the policy implementation working group reporting to this committee and going to this committee now to the contracting entity? I want to understand what the independent means. Is it independent of ICANN or independent of the community? Thank you.
Okay, good question. Alan wanted to speak to that anyway, so why don't we let Alan try and flesh this out a little, and in effect that's also a response to yourself, and then see if anyone else wants to come in on that.
Thank you, Jonathan. Alan McGilvery for the record. I think this issue was treated in the strawman matrix. There is a little, these ideas are not new about what this would be, and I think what was reflected in there was not a standing policy, but rather something, I guess the short form would be some kind of arbitration. In other words, there would be some kind of escalation. I note in RFP 2B, and we have all this detail, they have the treatment of something called the Independent Review Board, all right, which hasn't met, but I have to say that it's analogous to at least what I have in my mind about what this would be. In other words, not a standing committee. This would be largely a question, I'll use the legal term, adjudicating on whether a policy decision was consistent with policy. So it would not be a question of getting technical experts in. This would be more, you would get, reasonable men. They could be lawyers. They need not be lawyers. In a past life, I was involved.
They need not be men either, of course.
But certainly the way that the WTO resolves trade disputes is they create a list of knowledgeable individuals who are on a list or known to be knowledgeable. They understand trade agreements. Then when two countries are in a dispute, each country chooses one of the people from the list. In other words, they're qualified, and then those two choose the third. And the whole idea there is it's not standing, you don't have to pay for it, but at the same time, there's some pre-qualification. These are knowledgeable individuals. They're not known to have a particular bias one way or another, and they have some background in the area. So I think there's some merit in that, but I noticed, too, in the current process, actually reuses something called the International Center for Dispute Resolution. So I don't know anything about that, but there might be some issue about their content in this area. So that's what I would offer on how I would see that functioning. Thank you.
I think it might be helpful in the table, Marika, maybe change that the heading for that row from Independent Standing Policy Appeals Committee to Panel. Change committee to panel. I think it gets confused now with the kind of multi-stakeholder or customer committee.
And also the word standing?
Yeah, we could take that out. That, you know, doesn't have to stand. It'll be called on, you know, as needed.
But we need to have the standing was mostly meant that we have a predefined number of seats in this panel, because you need to have it to be able to act very fast if there is a problem. You don't want to go into a long process of getting a panel established.
Let's make that, Lisa, then a qualification that it needs to be able to act quickly. And we need to be very clear on this. This isn't about a discussion of policy. So we're not appealing the policy here. We are appealing the accurate implementation of a policy. So it's absolutely important that we get that right. Yeah, exactly. It's policy implementation appeals panel. That's more helpful. All right, great. Thank you. Yes, Bart.
Again, if you frame it that way, policy implementation, then you get the whole discussion around, for example, the applicant guidebook. Is that part of the implementation? Yes or no? Would that be appealable? But I think what you really want is a decision made under a policy which has been implemented. It's on individual cases where you want to have an appeal and not on policy in general.
So what's the correct form of wording? Let's nail this while we are. I know there's a queue, but let's try and just nail this because we know what we mean.
I would say decisions, say a policy decisions or decision under policy appeal mechanism. So you link the appeal with a individual case or individual decision. That's what you're after.
So, and then Marika removes the implementation. Okay, Malcolm, you appeared to want to respond directly to my question on wording, so just check what's there now and see if that needs tweaking.
In the title or in the bulk?
Either. Just making sure that we're crystal clear on the intent.
We did address this yesterday, and Donna came in with an addition in reply to me that I accepted, which is that it's the decision is about whether or not the appeal is about whether or not the decision conforms to the policy, i.e. accurately implements the policy, and also about whether the decision is in response to a policy that has been followed the correct procedure. It is indeed a genuine policy, not a pretended policy. Yeah?
Okay. Let's get the first one, because I didn't sense any objection to the first one, and let's just make sure there are no concerns with the second. So go back again. So what's
okay, so it's the decision is in conformance with agreed policy.
Any concerns or reactions to that? I didn't sense that there were, but just... Okay. So you've got that, Marika. Martin's waving a hand.
Oh, dear. Right, does that work?
Adobe
no.
Or Oliver?
I'm in mute. I'm not mic connected. Is that okay?
Yeah,
okay. I'm not quite sure that specifically responds to the point that Bart raised, and I'm outside my comfort zone because I don't do new GTLD policy, if I can avoid it. But if you've gone through the process that exists within ICANN that does the judgment, does it fit within the applicant guidebook and makes the decision, it then passes the request over to the IANA. And the bit that we are concerned about is when IANA receive that request and treat it, and it ends up with the entry going into the route. And I think actually the wording leaves me still with the fear that you would turn around in IANA and say, but did the ICANN process work properly, rather than just saying they have given us the checklist with all the ticks. And that sort of leaves me a little bit nervous.
You check the actual wording there and see what we've got, because it's we perhaps don't need to get absolutely stuck on it, because if you've got some, I don't want to get spend too long on it, because I think we've got a feel of the sense. But okay, here's some responses. So just to help, I'm not ignoring the queue. We're just taking trying to refine this component a little bit. So if you've got direct responses to refining this component, Martin, yeah. You're going to come back. Then I've got Alan, maybe anyone else, Mina.
I just wonder whether consistent with agreed IANA policy, to make it actually clear that it's the IANA bit, it's not the assessment evaluation bit.
I guess it's policy relating to IANA, because IANA itself doesn't make policy, of course.
Sorry. So I guess my concern is there's big policy, which is set by the SOs, and then there's what you're talking about, Martin, I think, is the IANA policy of how they implement that, which is more process. So we just need to be careful about using the word policy, because I don't think there is such a thing as IANA policy in how we think of policy that's done through the SOs.
All right.
And AC. So that's my concern.
Thanks, Donna. Two points, then I'll come to you, Alan and Kamina. Or one quick point is what we may want to think about is examples. Examples might flush it out of what, you know, what would be a typical example that we'd want to. Have there been examples which we'd want to refer to the policy appeals panel in the past? I've got Alan, Kamina, and then Malcolm on this.
Thank you very much, Alan Greenberg. My recollection is that there's already wording talking about in the section that Malcolm keeps referring to that says IANA must follow policy. There's the ICANN policy there, and there's some other sections within the IANA contract talking about what policies they must follow. So I think we really want to go to there for the words. IANA presumably does not make policy. They do have practices or processes. However, what I put my hand up for is we're using the term decision in two different ways here, and you can't tell from the spelling. In the title, this is a decision by an arbitration panel or something or other. I think the word decision on the third to last line is really action. That's whether IANA's actions are consistent with policy.
Maybe there's a little problem still with the title. Maybe it should be Independent Policy Decision Appeals Panel.
Well, the title is talking about a decision by some panel on whether an IANA action followed policy. So
I'm not sure that was actually what was intended, but maybe that's the way it reads or read until a nanosecond ago.
Well, I mean, IANA may make decisions.
Alan, you made an important point that I'd quite like to capture in the body of this as well, and that is that you made reference to the existing contract.
Yep.
So I think there should be a bottom bullet there, Marika, which says, see also existing IANA contract.
Yeah. Yep. Certainly for GTLDs is a reference to ICANN policy. There are presumably other sections that refer to other policies.
Okay. Great. So let's go to Kamina and then Malcolm, and then I think we're going to get onto the main queue again then.
Hello. Thank you, Kamina, for the record. I just wanted to highlight that perhaps it would be good to bring in line the wording on the principles on redress mechanisms, where the wording that we're using here to ensure coherency, And also I would like to add that there must be some sort of guarantee of independence, or some sort of mechanism to guarantee that it's a truly independent mechanism. We might discuss that, or even leave another placeholder for colleagues working on the accountability track, because according to my understanding and the views of our stakeholders, they will put to the fore in the accountability track a bigger arbitration body or arbitration authority that will come to take over all the different arbitration processes that are happening within ICANN. And I don't see a reason why this particular dispute resolution should live in isolation and completely separated from other processes, basically because we can end up with different dispute resolution processes yielding completely incoherent results. And also something that I would like to be captured in this draft is that whatever independent policy decision appeals panel we set up, it has to be based on dispute resolution and arbitration rules already existing in international law. And we have already a precedent, because some of our CCTLD colleagues do actually resort to the ICC arbitration panels. I think it will be much better than using any sort of instrument similar to independent review panel, the current internal review panel mechanism used by ICANN. And, I mean, I could put to the fore the proposals. I've been looking into the Hague Conventions for the law applicable to trust and their recognition. That might be a bit of an over-engineered solution. So I think that ICC is the framework that best suits our interest here.
So let's try and capture a few of those points, Camino, before we move on.
The main one would be based on dispute resolution and arbitration rules already existing in international law, and in between parentheses, ICC. And the second one I would like to see captured in the draft is guarantees for independence, or checks and balance for independence.
Yeah, which is in there already. That's
and the third is a placeholder for the cross-working group on accountability.
Exactly. Link through PWG on accountability.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. That's some constructive points there. Just making sure Marika has an opportunity to capture those linked to CWG on accountability. Okay, great. Malcolm?
Thank you, Chair. Malcolm Hutsey for the record. You asked for examples to flesh out what should be appealable and what should not. So I will speak from an example from the G space, because I'm more familiar with that. I think there were two categories of things that are appealable, and only two, and that they are these. Consider the circumstance of a initial delegation. A ICANN staffer sends to IANA an instruction for a delegation. I think that could be appealed under either of these two circumstances. One, that in the string being delegated is not in conformance with the policy, plainly at discrepancy with policy. For example, the policy says there are reserved words, reserved strings that shall not be delegated, and it's one of those strings. That's not in conformance with policy. That should be rejected and appealable on that basis. If it's accepted, should be appealable on that basis. The second one is there is a policy in place, and would allow for this, but that policy hasn't been executed. For example, the IANA staffer provides an instruction to delegate a domain that is under consideration for delegation but has not yet been approved. That's a failure of process. Yeah? So, for example, the last step in the agreement to delegate that domain is that the board needs to sign off on it. The board have not yet signed off on it, so the staffer should not have provided that to IANA for delegation. Yeah? So the policy and the process. Thank you. Nothing else. No other forms of appeal should be allowed.
Okay, thanks, Malcolm. I've got a long queue now, which is, I'll just let you know, you can see from the Adobe who you are. I won't read it out. We'll go to Alan McGillicfrey. Okay, Amar?
Thanks, this is Amar. I have a question, actually. It's, I'm wondering why we need to separate the periodic review team from the appeals panel. Is it because the composition might be different? I can see that there's a mechanism to appeal implementation of policy issues in the IANA context, and both of them are ad hoc groups that can, well, the periodic review team would have a schedule for being convened, but it could also be convened on an ad hoc basis. they're both multi-stakeholder, and to me the true value of multi-stakeholder involvement is to ensure that policies developed through the ICANN processes are being implemented properly within the IANA context. So I'm just wondering if there's a reason why they need to be separated.
I'll try and answer that, and then I'll open it up to anyone else to respond and answer that. My understanding is that the Standing Committee is a multi-stakeholder oversight body of the IANA function, and appropriately so. The Independent Policy Decision Appeals Panel is much more of a quasi-judicial arbitration type mechanism where that's a more technical, more specialist, more legal type function that looks at the rules or the policies in place and were they in that limited sense followed. Does anyone see it differently or have anything to add to that response to Amma?
Jonathan, when you say making sure that the policies are being implemented, like a very technical group or judicial, but we are talking about ICANN policies, right, developed by the SOs. We're not.
Not necessarily.
Sorry, I switched it off. Not necessarily, because it could be coming from a national CCTLD or there are various. Can someone else?
Try to, we can reframe it. I'm working with the CCNSO, so therefore I know a little bit. For example, there are, say, you have a policy on the delegation, redelegation of CCTLDs. One of the core principles of this whole delegation, especially in redelegation, is what's going on in country and if there is legislation in place, etc. And IANA. IANA is required to consider what is happening in country, and it's first and foremost, and what Paul has been stressing, what is in country, and therefore, as part of the overall policy, you see they have to refer back to what is happening in country, and sometimes it's very unclear, and they can take decisions which. Yeah, you want an independent review of whether this decision is in conformance with the overall policy, whether it has to be taken into consideration.
Just one final clarification. So is what we're saying that this appeals panel, its composition is not necessarily fixed. It could change according to the issue that's being brought forward, according, for example, to what country we're dealing with. Okay, thanks.
Going back to what Alan said, and if you, for example, look at the arbitration rules of the ICC, is the arbitration rules of the ICC will say they apply in some of these documentations of relations with CCTLDs, and if you look at them, is normally you see you have an independent chair and the two contesting parties choose one of the arbitrators, and which are all on a list. So it's very clear from day one who will be on the panel, and both parties have an influence. And you could, yeah, you can go into very more details, but that's the idea.
So this is a panel of arbitrators, and not a multi-stakeholder, you know, not members of the community. Wigs and robes and all that.
Hopefully we've all right. I'm conscious that we've got a queue which is now led by Peter van Roster.
Thank you, Johnson. Peter van Roster from Centre. First, an overall comment. We started yesterday off with building principles, and one of those very sound principles was the distinction between policy and operational aspects, implementation. And during this morning, and this has been happening for the last 2 hours, I hear more and more that very thin line is getting even thinner. So that's a point of concern. On the title of the, because my hand was up for about half an hour, so then you, at that point you asked to come up with suggestions for the title of that name. I don't feel comfortable with the Independent Policy Decision Appeals Panel, because that is almost removing that distinction between policy and operations. Before we know it, we're actually building a policy review panel here, and that cannot be the intention. So how about, and it becomes longer and longer, I do realize that, an independent appeals panel for policy implementation decisions. But I clearly make that distinction that it's about the implementation of the policy and the decision that has been made by ICANN. And then on another note, also throughout the morning, I keep on hearing reference to CCNSO when referring to CCTLDs. Your co-chair would not fit into that group, and that would be a shame. So just as a general reminder to refer to CCTLD community in that respect. Thanks.
Thanks, Peter, for both of those points. To the extent that I've been guilty of that reference, I apologize. And second, I would hope that we aren't crossing that thin line, and to some extent that you were concerned about the fact that we've got the policy appeals mechanism in one box and the IANA periodic review team in another feels to me like we have the line. So maybe if you could, are there any examples where that line's becoming thin, just make sure it doesn't happen, because I thought we were keeping the definition, the line, the thin line that you referred to. At least I thought the line was still solid.
When I heard the examples of the interpretation of policy decisions that have been made on a national level by IANA, then that line is almost gone. When we refer those decisions on delegation and transfer, and I probably should be referring to the FOI experts in the back of the room, when we're referring those type of decisions to an interpretation that the ICANN board makes of those local decisions, then policy sits where it should be sitting, not within an IANA policy implementation panel.
So check the wording that's there, have a think about it, and if there's anything we can do to help make that line bright, then Elise, do you want to respond directly?
Can I suggest we take out decisions to maybe make that line just policy implementation? It's not that they don't decide anything, they just implement. Could that make that line a bit thicker? Yeah?
Alan Greenberg next.
Thank you. Thank you. One of the things I don't think we've addressed here that we probably need to is who has standing to appeal.
Well, why don't we put that in as a question for the moment and not necessarily attempt to answer it on the fly. So we'll put it down the bottom as something that needs to be dealt with but not necessarily answered immediately.
That's fine.
Camino? So if you could, okay, Peter, Alan, Camino, remove your hands. Stephanie.
Just one more point to add to the two that Malcolm raised as potential things that would be covered under this. Also, I think the refusal to delegate something that has passed through all of the that has accorded with all of the applicable policies and procedures, not just delegating something that is still under consideration, but refusing to delegate something that has passed through the appropriate policies and processes.
Yeah, it's a really interesting example. Can I just ask a question? I'll make one point and one question. In my mind, and I've talked to you individually, a number of you, about this. I mean, the one example I've always been aware of is XXX. ICANN board made the decision, and there was much rumor about whether NTIA would actually follow, had the political will to follow through on not exercising the right of veto. And I guess that's to your point. So the question I was going to ask related to that is it useful to include examples here? Do examples add value to the definitions we're making? And if so, you know, let's capture them. It may be a detail too far. I mean, if we seem to have a pretty common understanding, so perhaps it's getting into the weeds, and we've got to be very careful not to do that, because this is our kind of final session on RFP3, and perhaps the examples are just useful for the group to focus the group and don't need to be written down. But if you feel it's necessary to capture the examples, in order to be secure in our definitions, then let me know. Greg?
I think that last example gets into the issue of what is policy when we're referring to this decision. Did they violate a consensus policy or another form of policy by delegating or refusing to delegate? If the policy is that IANA must delegate what it is given to delegate, and that it has no kind of free will in that regard, if they were to refuse, that would be a violation of policy. So, but I think to some extent, without having kind of the policies in front of us, so we're working a little bit in a vacuum.
Paul, you want to respond? And Stephanie, did you? Okay.
One more point in response to Alan. I would like to, in response to the question about who should have standing to appeal, suggest putting back on the table the language that I had introduced into the red line to straw man one, which is that there should be a binding appeals process available to parties that believe they have been materially and adversely affected by the failure of the IANA functions operator to carry out the IANA naming function in accordance with the applicable policies and procedures.
Caused a couple of other hands to go up there, but I so we've got Alan first and then Camino.
I would suggest that the body that made the policy should have a right to say that IANA is not carrying it out.
Concerns with that? Responses to Alan before I go to Camino? Camino?
Yeah, I would like to offer my comments to the proposal of Stephanie. I think that ties to the concept of harm, who has been harmed by any of these actions, and sometimes the definition of the threshold of how someone has been harmed is very complex. So perhaps for the time being, pending a legal analysis of that makes our wording more accurate. I would not accept that formulation as such because it engages us into legal trouble, but I would say that just affected or impacted parties, at least for the time being, and I agree that it should go in between brackets or parentheses because at a later stage we may want to have another formulation. But it is difficult to define now the threshold for harm.
That's very helpful, thanks. So what we have after the question mark is affected or impacted parties in square brackets, if I heard Camino correctly. So it puts a placeholder in there. It's not properly and finally defined, but it indicates a very broad but not legally defined set of. Okay, I've got responses from Paul and then Alan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to highlight the CCTLD survey, and I would like to emphasize and echo the point that Peter raised earlier, namely that a significant number of CCTLDs do not participate in the CCNSO, and also question the authority that ICANN asserts or seeks to assert over CCTLDs, particularly those CCs that existed prior to ICANN. So those CCs form the view that they are the authority in accordance with national law, not ICANN. So we have to make sure that in your deliberations going forward that that fairly significant group of CCs has their autonomy respected. Coming to the point I wanted to make, which endorses really Camino's point, the survey, we asked if the IANA operator does not perform well or abuses its position, the affected CCTLD should have the opportunity to an independent and binding appeals process. 94% wanted to have that mechanism in place. So binding appeals process. So, again, I want to emphasize the two points, binding, affected, and also there is a significant difference in the CC community between recognizing ICANN as an authority and recognizing the CC as the authority. I do have a statistic for that, actually, which is something like, I don't actually have it directly at hand, but it was something like 70% of the CCs that responded considered that they were the ultimate authority for the CC. So it's a big difference.
Okay, thanks, Paul. And so, you know, our deliberations are your deliberations as we go forward as well. I mean, you'll be here at the table and continue to be, as will other CCs who are not necessarily part of the CCNSO. So we can make sure that we accommodate that, I'm sure. Greg.
I think the conversation has gone by me, so I mean, gone by the point I needed to make.
Elise?
Thank you. This is something different than what we are discussing just right now. That is because we are filling in all the columns. I think we have the possibility to do that. So while I'm at it, I think that it goes to the composition of the IANA contracting entity. Just as I see it, if we give the standing committee and the periodic review group a clear status in the contract, than the entity of this contracting entity or who sits in it, isn't that important? It would help us, you know, to not have the fight of who's actually contracting with IANA if we seek to have this process put into the contract so it gives a status for the process. This is just a thought as I see it now when we go through the columns.
That's a helpful point, and just to respond to that directly, I and whoever was involved in defining this little mini-matrix we're working on now didn't presuppose and still have not yet presupposed either a format to that contracting entity other than it has the ability to contract, and moreover, have not presupposed that it is populated with individuals, and as you say, because it may well be that the individuals or representatives are covered in the IANA periodic review team and don't need to be in any way duplicated or emulated in the contracting entity. Yeah, go ahead, and then Greg wants to come.
Yeah, no, it's just because I see that we can have a discussion later maybe where we should give the standing for these committees and the mechanisms, and it could be into the bylaws, of course. If we give them some contracting status, I think it would help for the further discussion.
I think by definition it has to have sufficient standing, where I use that differently to a standing committee, it has to have sufficient substance in order to be able to contract. How it gleans that substance we have not yet determined. Greg?
Yeah, a couple of points in direct response. You know, first, I think that's, you know, in line with the way I've been thinking about this personally, that the committee, that the contracting body really needs to be a little more than a shell, in a sense, and that it delegate responsibilities to these committees. They don't need to be committees of the organization, but they can be delegated out to these committees. I think, you know, the less that this organization, that the contracting body does other than enter into a contract, and you don't need an awful lot of substance other than, you know, not being a sham, essentially, to enter into a contract. And the actual performance of the contract, you know, by this side, you know, can be delegated in large part to outside, but committees that are outside of that entity, and that could be, you know, the committees we've been discussing, such as the customer committee and their performance review team or committee.
Okay, I have Fatima next.
Thanks, Jonathan. Fatima, for the record, I will back to a point, and I have some questions. How you ensure the independence of the panel with the composition of the panel? With the mechanism to the composition of the panel, are we deciding this issue now? Who decides that? Thank you.
That's a really good question, because the principle and concept is one of independence, and you're saying, well, how am I convinced, and what characteristics might do that? I don't know. I'm not sure we want to go to that level of detail, but maybe someone has a comment on that, you know, how we ensure the independence of the appeals panel for policy implementation. Any comments or thoughts on that directly?
Isn't Rick, isn't that, you know, referring to what Camino said, that basically it has to be based on existing
arbitration rules and practices which presumably have independence as part of that? Maybe covered by that.
That's what I would have thought. That certainly would be where I would have thought so. Any other questions, comments, or responses to that? Camino and Greg? Camino first.
It's more of a question. In arbitration, do the panelists have to sign a conflict of interest policy? Because that could be a filter to add on top of the fact that it should be based on arbitration rules. Perhaps conflict of interest to ensure independence would be good, but I'm not sure whether that's accepted practice in arbitration. I'm not sure.
Just a direct response to that comment.
I think the best way, and maybe that's for future work, is if you suggested the ICC, and in conjunction refer to the ICC rules of arbitration, because that's a whole set of rules which are well thought through, and you don't want to amend them or anything else. But my guess is it's dealt in that in the arbitration rules itself.
Okay, I've got a response from Greg, and then I'm aware I've got Alan Martin and Sean in the queue.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and it kind of echoes Bart, and that independent, impartial is really kind of a root requirement of arbitration. If the arbitrator is an interested party, then it's a kangaroo court. It's not an arbitration. So I think that ICC and organizations like that have gained their legitimacy by being independent and impartial, to the extent that there's issues with impartiality. They think they've dealt with them. Clearly, it needs to be part of that. Any choice we make needs to be one that ensures independence and impartiality. But I think that by going to an existing set of international, not just existing rules, but to an existing body that organizes panelists and runs them, that they are kind of staking their reputation on independence and impartiality.
Okay. Alan Greenberg?
Thank you. I'm going back to what we were talking about before on the grounds for appealing or standing for appealing and Stephanie's suggestion of harm. I'll point out that in the GTLD world, it is quite conceivable that a policy is set which is not supported by the registries, and therefore you could in fact have a registry claiming they were harmed because the policy was followed. GNSO can pass policies without the agreement of at least one stakeholder group. So I really have a problem with the word with harm staying up there as one of the targets.
Okay, direct response from Stephanie.
I think in this context, a GTLD registry feeling that they are harmed by the existence of a policy is very different than someone being harmed by the failure to properly apply policy, which is what this would be limited to.
My point, that was an example. My point was I don't believe you should need to show harm to be able to demonstrate that IANA is not following policy.
All right. Well, I think in an earlier dialogue on that, we agreed that was when we had the introduction from Camino, and I'm just trying to look where that was, where we had a square bracketing. I don't see those square brackets. Binding appeals process available to parties. Yeah, are they sufficiently square there, or they look a bit round to me? Exactly. So I'm saying I think what we agreed to do was to deal with the harm isn't in there at the moment. We were going to go to a more expert definition of that wording at a later stage. At the moment, it's simply direct response, Camino, and then I should get back to the queue.
Thank you, Camino, for the record. Materially, in between parentheses, for me, it points at harm already in a certain sense. So I think that if we further explore how someone is being materially harmed, we have the concept of harm already represented. I just suggested before that we didn't dive into that legalistic concept right now because I think it was a loss of time. But I think that materially, I would prefer to see it out, but materially already reflects to harm in a certain sense.
Materially is out. Marika, just on a point of process here, I mean, the reason they square is they are different to round. Yeah, exactly. Square means they're subject to further revision. Round is simply, yeah, okay, you got it. Fine. All right. I've got Martin next.
Thank you, Chair. Martin Boyle. I'd actually like to go to the IANA contracting entity because one of the things that, as we've had that sort of various discussion, that I am assuming that for all of the IANA functions, we have one and only one IANA contracting entity. And that means that this committee here would have to take inputs in a similar sort of way from numbers and protocol parameters sides. But it also does mean that when you get to making a decision, you've got three different feeds into that that would then impact your decision as to whether you needed to recontract or not. So I'm just sort of putting my hand up and saying that, yes, in the table, we do need to sort of perhaps start building bridges to some of the other communities about their thinking on the contracting entity and also ensure that what we put in place takes in the feeds from all of them rather than that we set up three separate contracting entities. Thanks.
So can that be a... Yeah, I think Marika's going to do that. Needs to take input from other... other IANA functions. Now, I'm just going to make a point here just to make sure at present there is no presumption that there is another committee other than there's not necessarily an additional committee associated with the IANA contracting entity. There's no unique committee. If you go up, Marika, if you can just scroll up. At present, we only have two bodies of persons, if you like. One is the Independent Appeals Panel, and the other is the one is the IANA Periodic Review Team, and one is the IANA Customer Standing Committee. So there is no presumption as yet that there is any third group of individuals that deal with contracting, save for the hire and retention of professionals to deal with the contracting legal elements of contracting. I've got Sean.
Thank you, Jonathan. This is Sean. Just quickly want to respond to Martin. I think I very much support his comment about thinking with the other community, especially in regards to the contracting entity. I've actually raised some of this before via other lists, and one of the responses I got then was that it is left for ICG to worry about. So maybe they have some magic that they will use to figure that out. Back to my main comment. So I want to comment on the Independent Appeal Panel for Policy. I think I want to be clear, is the panel going to be doing review with the aim of making a decision or with the aim of providing a recommendation? First, I'd like to see appeal. I would like to see the word review go between appeal and panel. And also, I'd like to get clarification on the question of whether this panel will be reviewing to make a decision or reviewing to recommend, make a recommendation. Also, on this page, it looks like we started building some content. Can I understand what the first column is and what the second column is? What's the title of this page actually?
Okay, I'm going to answer and then expect any challenges to that answer. As far as the review of the decision is concerned, my understanding and expectation currently is that that will be binding, not advisory. Second, and please challenge me if you think differently, as far as the column headings are concerned, what we're talking about here is bodies or groups required to perform the NTIA functions in a post-NTIA world, and then a detailed description of those roles or functions.
Thank you, Jonathan. Can you tell me how does this differ from the previous document you were looking at?
I think there we were looking at functions and characteristics without any presumption of what the body or groups would look like. So what we attempted to do here was, but we were kind of getting stuck there because we didn't have a picture of what those groups would do. So this attempted to leapfrog us a step further and say, okay, now we've got a feel for the functions, the characteristics of those functions, and other elements that are in that table. Maybe it'll help us if we actually have a proper visual and actual picture of what the entity is. So what I think we're trying to do now is galvanize our view and our thoughts around what those entities might look like.
I think more simply, here we're showing who will perform those functions. You know, previously we were defining what those functions were. Here we're showing who will perform them.
Erika, to respond?
Yeah, and this is Erika, and I think the next step would be once we have the characteristics, this would allow us as well to show the relationships, or at least that's, you know, why we're doing it in the flowchart, and I think the idea would be to take this out, you know, the different descriptions and put that separately, but then be able to show how do all these bodies interact and have the kind of relationship flow that would be, at least from my perspective, the natural next step, I think, in this process.
Yeah, thank you very much. Just to make a comment on what Greg said, I don't think what we have here right now is already talking about who is performing the functions. Because I think what we're just doing right now is more of characteristics too. That's what it looks like to me. If the goal is to also indicate who will perform the functions, then I think we should, before we kind of have another long characteristics, we should take note of that and kind of make a very strong progress. Thank you.
So just to check that, is there any objection to Sean's point, which says independent appeals review panel for policy implementation, so the addition of review?
Yeah, that doesn't make sense to me.
Okay. Sorry.
It's redundant. I mean, if it is a review or an appeal, it's a panel to which an appeal is made after an implementation decision is made that may violate policy.
Okay, maybe I'm not wasn't very descriptive enough. My point is, this panel is independent and is assumed not to be part of the community, assumed not to be part of the process. It's going to be making decisions or observations based on the documents or the information provided for it. So I would expect that it's a reviewed kind of thing like that. Also, well, if you don't think that word is important, that's fine. But it's very, very important to clarify in the content, that is the other column, whether it's going to be a decision-making body, whether it's going to be making decisions or it's going to be making recommendations.
So, Sean, at the first sentence it says binding policy implementation appeals mechanism. Okay.
See, that is then.
Okay, great. All right.
I would just say that, you know, an appeal is by definition a review because it is an appeal from something, and therefore it is reviewing the original decision or action that's been made. So I think it's redundant.
Okay, so I think we've got two more people in the queue. That's Robert and Greg. And then we do probably need to start to look at we need to move this on another step. We've made very good progress, and we need to move this on another step. So let's hear from Robert and then Greg.
This is Robert for the record. Just in regards to the IANA contracting entity, what is mentioned is the development of requirements, but nothing is mentioned there in terms of what the selection of proposals might be and how that criteria gets defined and who does that. So in case an RFP is issued, how that what to look for in the selection didn't seem to be mentioned. So that's one point. I think secondly, I think maybe it's implied, and so it's fine. It may have been defined earlier. All these different, for the contracting entity, we may want to make sure that it's financed accordingly as well. So I'm not sure if that, if we want an independence, that it be adequately, that it have an adequate budget. Thank you.
Thanks, Robert. That adequately captured that, I think it is. And then I've got you next, Greg.
Yeah, I think that Robert's point and Martin's point previously kind of speak to the same issue. In order for the contracting entity, there's kind of two ways to look at this contracting entity. One is, you know, as I said, it holds the contract. It is a party to the contract. The question of whether the party to the contract is also the party that decides who is the counterparty to the contract is, I think, an open question, whether that is going to be part of the activity of the contracting entity or whether, you know, that is in essence going to be delegated to, you know, say, a multi-stakeholder committee is, I think, it's a critical question. But I don't think we should assume that it's going to be, say, officers of the contracting entity that would make that decision as to what an RFP would look like, and who would, who that RFP would be ultimately awarded to. And I think, you know, this is a situation where we probably begin to need to dovetail to some extent with numbers and protocol parameters. Potentially, not necessarily, but that the contracting entity, you know, there could be, you know, a panel put together. I think this kind of goes back to one of Avery's suggestions that, you know, at the time that the contract is essentially up, a panel, would be put together that would put together an RFP and decide, you know, whom to award it to. Eduardo?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Eduardo. I just have a question. Are we also talking here on which, where these groups are going to be located? Are they going to be located within ICANN or external to ICANN? Is that something that we're going to discuss here, or we're just talking specifically about the groups?
So my feeling is, I was just conferring with Lisa about this, I think this has been a very productive session. We seem to have a lot of convergence, which is great. Our current plan is to have another half an hour and then break for lunch at 12. Seems to me that we could do with a little break now, absorb what we've done, and maybe push lunch out by another half hour or so. It seems like we've just had breakfast and coffee. I'm wondering if anyone would be, is the sense of the group that we can take a 10 or 15 minutes and then come back for another hour before lunch. Are you happy to do that? Great. All right, let's do that. Let's take a break, regroup, and then we'll come back in about, let's say 15 minutes now, and then we'll do 11:45 to 12:45 and have lunch at 12:45. Okay, everyone, we'll begin in just 1 minute. If you could take your seats at the table, and we'll try and do this final session before lunch and get going on that. Okay, thanks everyone. So we'll do a session now which will be approximately an hour or as necessary, and which will take us up to around 12:45 when we'll break for lunch, and we'll give you an updated afternoon schedule when we come back from lunch. So what we're trying to do now is bring, having set out these different structures and got what seems to be a reasonably common view of their functions, is to start to perhaps talk about the interrelationships between them, perhaps touch on the composition, although I think we've got to be careful not to go into too much detail there because we could spend hours on that. And that's really, I'm not even sure we'll go into trying to cross-correlate these with the straw man. I think that might have to be done offline. I think we'll find some elements of the straw man simply cascade out of the work that we've done here. So, Marika, are you going to put the document we had previously? Donna, go ahead.
Thanks, Jonathan. I just have a question. So one of the things that we haven't covered in any of this is the authorization role that NTIA currently performs and who replaces that. And it struck me that the independent review or the review mechanism we're talking about is potentially where that comes into play as well. So if there's a recommendation from IANA to delegate, and I think this is what you were talking about with the Triple X decision, and whether NTIA did not choose to delegate given, pressure that they had received from other governments. So I don't know that we've actually addressed that authorization role yet, and whether, I'm just wondering, whether we intend to do that at some point during the day.
That's a really good question. I guess that there's an... Let me come back to that. I'm just going to make a couple of points about what we're going to do in this session, and then I've made that as a note. So where are we right now? We've got these various entities or groups that are set up. It feels to me like we're developing some common understanding. What we haven't talked about in any detail, and I'm going to put this out to you as to what it feels to me that it is, and then I'm going to ask you to challenge or support that, is in and around the relationship between, I'm going to call these 1, 2, 3, and 4. In other words, the standing committee is 1, the periodic review team is 2, the independent appeals panel is 3, and the IANA contracting entity is 4. And really what we need to be sure about or clear about is the relationship between the periodic review team and the contracting entity, because what we've talked about is not having, is keeping that contracting entity at a minimum and simply being the counterparty to the contract. In order for that to be as minimalistic as possible, it needs to have a relationship with a body of substance, which currently looks like the number 2, the IANA periodic review team. So, in effect, 2 supervisors, 4 periodic review team supervisors the contracting entity, which means that the contracting entity does what the periodic review team tells it to do and doesn't have independence to do what it likes, what it might other. So there's no need to populate the contracting entity with, for example, multi-stakeholder input, because that's all covered in its supervisory function up at the periodic review team level. So we could talk about and confirm and affirm between us that relationship is satisfactory. The second thing we could think a little bit about, but I'm really reluctant to go into a lot of detail, is the composition of 2. I think the room has a common understanding that the composition of 2 is multi-stakeholder, and which means it might look something like the composition of this room to give a feel for it, but there have been some other points raised about referencing others outside the naming community, for example. And then this point that four, that is the contracting entity, is bound to implement the decisions of two, whether that's entering into a contract, terminating a contract, setting new terms and conditions for that contract on a periodic basis. And ultimately, if we manage to sort that out, it feels to me like we'll be many elements and questions in and around the straw man should simply fall away because we've essentially developed the structure here. And then finally, there's Donna's point about the authorization role. Now, where we provisionally got to yesterday is that there is perhaps no longer a requirement, and you'll need to confirm or question this, there is perhaps no longer a requirement for an authorization role, and I think that's the point that Donna was making, that in effect, to the that the IANA simply authorizes the outputs of the relevant policy, and to the extent that that has not been done correctly, we go to the independent appeals panel. So it's rather than the current position where the NTIA nominally has this final veto right, in a sense the veto right drops away and is replaced by an appeal mechanism. So really I guess what I'm looking for or proposing to hear from you is responses to affirm or deal with those in a sense assertions I've made. So that in consultation with the co-chairs and the keep wanting to call them team leads, the coordinators. Yeah. So Malcolm, your hand is up.
Thank you, Chair. Malcolm Hattie for the record. Okay, if I let me just repeat some of what you just said, just to ensure that I've understood correctly. The contracting team that is going to be just driven by the periodic review team. It's going to have no independent decision making or anything. It's just going to be essentially a carrying out function. Now, as for the contents of the contract, there are things that some people in the community are going to want to see in that contract that are related to the accountability issues. And we've got on there the list, the link there, linked to CWG on accountability. The structure that that you've just suggested would mean that the only route for those that had those issues and wished to raise them would be to join the periodic review team, because they can't join the contracting team directly, so they join the periodic review team, which directs the contracting. I just point out that the effect of that would mean that you would have a group of people engaged with the periodic review team that may have no particular interest in most of the ordinary routine work of the periodic review team. They're just there because they want to engage with this particular element. That may be seen as a weakness in the structure, or it may be something you're willing to have. But I'd point it out. Is that clear? I'm seeing.
So, I'm going to do what you did to me. I'm going to play it back to you, just make sure I've understood. What you're saying is, as far as the periodic review team is concerned, some people would only have an interest in coming to the party if and when the contract was up for detailed discussion, either renegotiation and/or review, and you've effectively brought them to the table for much more regular business of that periodic review team, because that's the only place they have a seat at the table. Any other thoughts or comments in and around that? I've got Greg next.
I think that's a good point. I think that what's clear to me, I think, is that in terms of kind of the composition of the, let's call it the contract review team, and the periodic review team, in terms of it being multi-stakeholder, I think those characteristics are identical. It may not be that the actual people filling the seats should be identical. the periodic review team would be either a standing committee or would be periodically brought together whenever an issue was raised for review, whereas the contract review team would only be raised when the contract itself was up for review, renewal, rebid, and the like. So I think that while the empty seats could have the same names of organizations on them, the tuchuses in the seats, to use a technical term, would not have to be the same tuchusim. Thank you.
Olivier?
Thank you, Jonathan. Olivier speaking. I would argue a slightly different angle and say that in the composition of these review teams, it would obviously show what these review teams would have to do, so you would always have interested individuals that would be sitting in those teams. I certainly can't imagine someone not interested at all in the periodic review, in some aspects of the periodic review, to actually apply to be on the panel or on the committee or the team itself.
Well, don't forget as well that the groups that had those seats would have to put people forward, and to the extent that the contract was up for discussion as opposed to the performance of the function, those groups might be expected to put different people forward to fill those seats. Bernard, Bernie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bernard took up. Yes, following on Jonathan's point, I think this is exactly it. It's not necessarily that this periodic review team, or whatever name we end up calling this group of the greater community, will do the work themselves. Maybe they will choose people who are interested and have the time to work, or may even contract certain types of people for special expertise to develop what is needed. The second thing we seem to be forgetting is that all through our discussions, we've committed very strongly to open participatory processes that are transparent. I mean, I would imagine that anything that is going on in here, on top of picking people to represent the right groups to participate in an effective fashion, that there would be process requirements for open consultations and participations by the community, so that we're not excluding any views from the input that we will consider in generating these things. So, to my mind, there's not much of an issue here, because it has to be by, unless someone has changed something, our transparency and participation requirements, even above and beyond what we're talking about in the committees, are quite extreme and should remain so in my mind. Thank you.
Thanks, Bernie. I've got Alan and then Paul.
Thank you. Bernie brought up the point I was going to make. Any review team that I've participated in or seen or in both ICANN environments and other places, it's not just their ideas that get taken into account. They actively solicit input and consider it. So I disagree with Malcolm that if you're not at the table, your ideas don't get considered. That's not the concept of review teams as I know it. Thank you.
Donna?
Thanks, Greg. Donna Austin. So I think Jonathan's characterization of the authorization steps, now if that goes away, in my mind that puts more responsibility onto IANA and the functions they perform, because they don't have that kind of backstop that NTIA provided in terms of authorization. Now, understanding that it is primarily a clerical step or administrative step, it's still could be seen as a political one as well. So I don't disagree that we don't necessarily need that authorization step, but perhaps when we get into RFP 4, we really need to think about the consequence of taking that out. So it's just a concern.
Okay, so before we come to Paul, that's a really good point. And I if you remember, in a previous document we were working on, it was in yellow, certainly not red. So in that sense, that maybe works quite well for this purpose, because it has the prospect of being removed. Much of what we do could assume it will be removed, but it isn't certain that it will be if in dealing with RFP4 we face concerns. And anyway, just to emphasize one other point, right now nothing is certain, in the sense that what we are certainly doing is preparing a draft for public comment. So it's quite possible that in preparing that draft for public comment, which goes out on December 1st, we get shot down in flames for the removal of the authorization function, at which point it goes from yellow to green again. But our current working assumption is it's sitting in yellow. It's certainly not red. And you're right. The fact that it's yellow means we need to be mindful of the consequences of that. Because there's a kind of consequence both ways. If it remains, who does it? And if it goes away, how do we ensure that that additional responsibility that IANA then picks up can be managed?
If I could just directly respond to that, I think one thing to think about, too, is it's a job or a function that's clerical except when it's not. And that's the problem with it. I've heard, police work described as 90% boredom and 10% terror. The percentages may be wrong for this job, but the description may be right. So the question is, getting rid of the boredom section of it and avoiding this kind of rote checklist by whoever, grabs the pad, might make sense. But how do we do that without throwing out this gatekeeper function on the terror side of things? Maybe that's just something to think about as we think about whether we can we somehow have only a structure there, or a function, somebody performing that function that is only brought to bear when things get ugly, and the rote checklist part can be replaced by automation or by nothing at all. I don't know if there's an answer to that, but it's something to think about.
Yeah, and or is it covered elsewhere, like the ability to remove the contract, like the appeals mechanism? Is that terror component covered elsewhere? I had Paul, and then Alan Greenberg. We'll go to you.
So I would just like to raise a couple of points. Again, I hate to refer to it all the time, but I think it's quite a useful reference, certainly for the CC community, at the recent survey. Respecting, and this is the thing I'm trying to emphasize each time I come to the microphone, there's a significant difference between the GTLD world and the CCTLD world. Unfortunately, from December, I'm not going to be online as much as I have been previously. But let me just read three comments from different CC managers. And I think it's sort of according with where we are, but one of them has financial ramifications. Independent multi-stakeholder oversight function and an independent redress function. Clear accountable mechanisms towards, that's one comment. Clear accountable mechanisms towards the community. High transparency level, not-for-profit body, timely mannered procedures, performance management, appeals / objection handling. That's the second submission. The third submission, oversight should only be legal and in jurisdiction. If IANA impacts the operation of a CCTLD registry, ICANN IANA must indemnify and pay damages to the impacted parties. So it's quite, in CC land, it's quite an onerous task to the entity that is going to be doing the authorization. So I would advocate yet again that it remains in CC registry responsibility.
So, Paul, can I just mirror that back to you? The third point is more subtle, but I heard that you gave a solution to this. The first two appeared to correspond quite well with what we're doing. That I didn't hear anything that contradicted, and I just want to make sure that no one else did. They seem to dovetail pretty well. Malcolm.
Thank you. I'm just going to pick up on a couple of things that have become clearer since I spoke before about what was being suggested or what some of the assumptions being approached. I mean, I didn't realize when I spoke before that at least some people are assuming that this team is a closed team. It was only when Greg started talking about, I can't remember the foreign language words, but non-English language words, but clearly referring to the appointment of particular individuals, and then the replacement of particular individuals to fill the same seat, implying a defined number of seats for a defined thing. Now, that is one option, but it's not the only option. An open participation is, at least I would think, is something that we would want to consider without, not dismiss it without consideration. I mean, this group, I'm glad to say, is open participation. I'm benefiting from it. So we look at what that group is likely to be doing most of the time. And certainly when we spoke before in some of our previous analysis, most of the things that we imagined this group to be doing were principally of interest to the directly affected parties. We'd identified that on the charts that we'd done, I believe.
Malcolm, just to come back on that, maybe Lisa wants to as well, just to make sure. I think when we talk about directly affected parties, we're talking about standing committee. When we're talking about as a team, I think you're talking about this as a periodic review team. Mm-hmm. And you're right, the composition and whether that's how that works is at the level you're touching on is something we should discuss. Lisa, just to check if you had another response as well.
I just wanted to add that most of the multi-stakeholder models we're operating with are open and open for participation. You might not be a member, but like you're here as a participant, able to talk. Most of it is to make sure that things are done, so you have a certain amount of members that are responsible, but it's not that anything is closed for everyone else to add into it. Not to get into details, but...
And I would just add, too, that I was not implying that it was a closed group, but rather that, at a minimum, it would be a representative group, rather than a group that would only represent, would be uni-stakeholder or bi-stakeholder, as opposed to multi-stakeholder.
Right, okay. And so that really comes to, you know, the point that I was originally raising, was that if the work, most of the work of this group is principally of interest to actually quite a small segment of the people that might turn up, but one group of it, one segment of that work is of interest to a much wider community. Doing that all in the same group and leading that way may confuse the work of that group, and you may find that there's a core group of experts that want to work on more routine matters in a much more sort of ordered fashion. And that work is, they're finding that slightly disrupted by the fact that there are, in the same room, a bunch of people who are actually trying to talk about something completely different and much broader. So whether or not, just for the point of view of putting those things together, whether they best lie together, or whether it, you know, one might consider, I'd suggest that there might be an issue to consider as to, for orderly management, separating out substantially different things, since they are likely to attract the interest of different communities.
I think first, you know, we have the standing committee, which I think would be, you know, primarily customer driven, and so that group I think would not be, you know, distracted by, in essence, you know, folks with, you know, very different, you know, focuses and agendas and skill sets, kind of wandering into the room. I think that group should still have liaisons to the larger multi-stakeholder community, but by and large should be, you know, customer driven. I think if we get to what we're, you know, currently calling the IANA periodic review team, I think even there, I think if I'm getting your point right, there are those who would be most concerned with periodic review, operational excellence, let's say, and others who would be more thrilled to be involved in the RFP process and the negotiation or supervision of negotiation of the contract. So just for example, in my own constituency, in the intellectual property constituency, I would think that Jonathan Zuck would be real interested in the operational excellence and review side. And I, or a large number of others, but not Jonathan, who's not a lawyer, for instance,
would not be so interested in the RFP process, although, you know, everyone, of course, would be free to have input, but, you know, just, you know, and I may be less interested in the operational excellence, you know, periodic things are not going the way they should discussions, and more interested in the now it's time for the contract to be, you know, taken care of time. So I think there may need to be, the periodic review team may need to be kind of split in two on the chart, that there's a periodic review team and a contracting team, neither of which are the contracting entity. The contracting entity is, as I see it, basically a shell that has the minimum life necessary in order to be the counterparty to a contract on the other side of the IANA functions operator. So I think when Paul Kane asked me yesterday, why shouldn't it be brain dead, my answer to Paul is, I think actually now you're pretty much right. The contracting entity needs to be close to brain dead. It's going to be borrowing the brains of the contract review team, which will be a multi-stakeholder, multi-stakeholder group. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, it was that sort of split that I was suggesting was signaled. That's exactly what I meant. I'm not proposing this as something I'm wedded to, but I certainly think that sort of split we should look at.
Okay, thanks, Malcolm. Let's capture that as that we can put under the IANA periodic review team. I think the way to handle that might be to say, well, not necessarily to commit yet to teams, but to commit to potentially different skill sets based on interest in outcome. And it may be that by definition produces two teams, but it's not the only mechanism by which the different skills or the different tasks. So you might say something like, consider, Marika, if we can you edit that online at the moment, or is it consider different skill sets based on task of the periodic review team?
Jonathan, that does tend to suggest one or no split, but different people. May I suggest instead that what we should capture is that there is a question, one or two. Does it need to be split or should
Fine.
It be combined?
Okay, no problem. All right, let's move on then to Olivier.
Thank you, Jonathan. Olivier speaking. And I realize we're working on building committees and teams and or plus or minus the S, of course, committee, team, panels, and so on. And, of course, these are all being built for specific purposes based on the functions that we want to be able to achieve. But when Donna mentioned the one part, which was the validation part, which NTIA is currently performing and which might not be performed or might in a different way, I don't know, I wonder whether it would be helpful to build some case scenarios to find out if what we're building at the moment is not a car with square wheels. If we actually have specific cases that we know are very litigious in nature or might have happened in the past or might happen in the future, and whether what we have built will actually be able to deal with those cases. And I don't know if it's RFP4 that deals with this. Yeah, I wonder that.
So I think that's very much RFP4, and it gets to the point of the stress test, in a sense, is what you're suggesting.
Thank you.
So that's a really good point, and it's ultimately a premature sounds disparaging. I don't mean it by that. It's, just, in a sense, a premature segue into RFP4, which we will come to.
To flag this for RFP4. Thank you.
And good point. Bernie?
Thank you, sir. Bernard Turcotte. Taking up on Donna's point of view, I think Greg did a good job illustrating some of the problem. It's X percent complete boredom and very small X percent possible terror. And part of the reality, as brought up by Olivier, is it was being performed by the U.S. government. It gives some people a pause to think they're going to attack that. So we're going to have to be very careful about how we think we reconfigure this. But what I was going to say is there may be alternatives. One of them we can consider is that actually if we look what IANA is actually producing currently, there are two reports which go to the board, which we now, finally, after years, get access to. And one of those reports actually describes how it meets and follows policy. So in some sense, if you take out the decision process and insist that those reports continue flowing, you could have an analysis of those to see if you're actually tracking to policy without having to bear the brunt of approving or not something. Just an option I'm pointing out to people. So it's not an all or nothing scenario in my mind. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Bernie. Donna?
Thanks, Jonathan. So, Donna Austin. So just to the GTLD reports that IANA developed now, one of the, and no offense to the GAC people in the room, one of the, you know, as you look at those reports, there's a checklist of things that they have to tick off on. One of them is whether it's followed GAC advice. And given that there is some contention within the GAC about whether the board is, the NGPC is following GAC advice, and it, currently the GAC has actually strongly gone back to the board on a couple of interpretations. My concern is that without that backstop, which NTI currently performs, it opens up that question of, for every GTLD delegation report that goes forward, that question of, has it followed GAC advice? So to me, that's a potentially a live issue for the GTLD reports that are going forward. So if there's not that backstop and somebody else to say that, you know, we'll tick the box on that, it's good to go, my concern is that we might get interference. And I'm not saying it will be the case, but it's just a flag that's out there for me.
If I could reply to that?
Who's asking to reply?
Bernie.
Bernie, go ahead.
I agree with Donna's point. I understand it. There's a couple of things. Is which party do you want to set in that giant mousetrap is one of the key questions. The second point is, although what you raise is valid and of concern for a few GTLD concerns, I don't think overall it's any kind of an interest for the issue. The corner cases don't go away. I agree with you, but if we try to look at this as overall, I don't think there, on one aspect, it comes back to the 99% board and 1% absolute terror. I understand that, and I think that's one of the things we have to consider.
What's not clear to me in this is whether or not this starts to also bleed into the issue of accountability, although that's not quite sure of the overlap here. Certainly, what's interesting about the authorization issue is that it's likely that authorization, I'm trying to think if there would be a positive authorization. To me, it seems that the only issue is the relevant policy entity or organization passes through the checklist, seeks to have the action performed by IANA, and what I've called the veto takes place. So it's a refusal to undertake an action, as opposed to, I wonder if there are cases when it might be that IANA takes an action without being instructed to. But it strikes me that certainly that the latter goes straight to the independent appeals panel when the action is taken without instruction. So it seems to me that the whole authorization is all about, or this issue, this question over the authorization is whether or not the IANA refuses to undertake an action requested by the relevant policy entity. And in a way, by removing that right of refusal or that capacity to veto, doesn't that depoliticize it as opposed to politicize it? You know, or that's
Jonathan, is burning.
Yeah, I've got Donna, you've got your have I got responses to that? Bernie clearly wants to respond to that. Martin and Sean, your hands are up. Are you responding to that? All right, then let's do it in order. Bernie, if you could put your hand up and we'll do Martin, Sean, and then Bernie.
Martin Boyle. Thanks. I must admit, I actually have quite a number of concerns here, not least because of the putting back a gatekeeper into a process where I really don't think we should be putting in a gatekeeper. But at the same time, I do have a lot of sympathy with the point that Donna's just raised. But then I thought that where did the system go wrong? And in that particular case, the system went wrong in the ICANN part, in the approvals process part. And therefore trying to put it right in the IANA is sort of using the IANA for something it wasn't really supposed to be doing. Better would be to say, right, okay, if the board has made a decision, if the report has gone forward and they've lied, there is quite a substantial accountability issue here, the pure fact that it's been falsified. And then I would expect the GAC to have very serious problems with it, probably with quite a loss of support from other communities as well, because you've got something systemic that is really, really an issue here, that the decision-making process is ticking a box when actually there should have been a cross in the box. But I'd sort of back away from, you know, unless it is something that is associated with the way that the IANA team are carrying out their job, then we shouldn't be putting any sort of gatekeeper function in there. We should sort out exactly where the problem lies. Thank you.
Thanks, Martin. Sure.
Thank you, Jonathan. Just to be clear, this is not a response to, it's a different thing entirely.
So, Bernie, go ahead.
Thank you, Sir Bernard Turcotte. Great point, Martin. Thank you. That covers part of what I was going to say. And the other part I think Jonathan made earlier in response to Donna's concern, let's not forget that the independent review is also there for the corner cases and the things that we can't handle any other way. So it's not like there's a gaping black hole here. There, if we go through this, there's always a way out to address some of these issues. Thank you.
Okay, let's go to... I'll make just one other remark here, because it was something that Matthew raised with me at the interval, and I don't want to send us off on another tangent, but the thread we haven't drawn together completely yet, and I don't think we can, which is partly related to this issue of the authorization role, is the work that's going to be done on accountability, and in particular where that accountability links directly to the transition of the IANA function. So we do have a little gap in our work that needs to have a close eye kept on. And if you go back to our charter, the charter refers to that, and it's implicit in all that we're doing that we cannot complete our work entirely without a link through to the accountability work track. So just to bear that in mind, and I just say I think we have to accept that it's in a sense there's an open item there. So sorry for keeping you, Sean, but go ahead now.
Thank you, Jonathan. I just want to comment on the two titles, the first two titles, the IANA customer and the IANA periodic review team. Again, I assume that the section that describe is actually talking about the attributes of those committees. Perhaps it's important before we finally release this document, it would be better to put that appropriate title so that we actually know what is listed so that people who are not part of this committee, when it's released to them, they know what is actually that section is for. My main comment is, do we really need to, perhaps we should put a description of where the committee members for the first two will be sourced from, because right now it's saying IANA customers. I don't know, is that going to be within the ICANN community? Because I'm also looking at it as creating a double working groups here, because it looks like something like this can be easily set up within ICANN. I don't think we really need to create a new committee for especially those first two topics, because it looks like it's already something that is existing. Perhaps we should also note it in the document we are creating.
If I could respond to that, I think that, you know, first, the committees themselves don't exist, but you know, the in terms of where they're sourced from, I think IANA customers, you know, would be CCTLDs and GTLDs, and you know, those would include obviously CCTLDs that are members of CCNSO and those that are not. So I think that is the source. I personally still want to add to that first line liaison to the multi-stakeholder community as well, but you know, primarily that would be sourced from the customers. So while it's a new committee, it doesn't necessarily mean creating a new committee that is somehow it has to have some sort of independent legal existence, whether it's technically an ICANN committee or just some an organization that tends to get together, a group that tends to get together. Is something maybe we need to nail down, but it would not be limited to CCNSO member CCTLDs. As far as the periodic review team, I think it's sourced from the multi-stakeholder community, which again includes CCTLDs that are, you know, whether or not they are, you know, members of the CCNSO, as well as the other SOs and ACs, and conceivably, maybe I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Let's go. Did you want to?
I think I'd like to kind of. I'm not sure I get what Greg just said now, because are you saying that, okay, the way it's going to look like is the standing committee will be composed of the CCTLDs and the GTLDs. Their work or their outcome or their output will get fed into the IANA periodic review team, and then that is where the multi-stakeholder comes in. Is that what you're saying? I need to understand the flow here.
I think it's a little bit different from that, in the sense that the standing committee's work would be to review the day-to-day performance, SLA compliance, and the like. I think as long as it was business as usual, they wouldn't feed that necessarily to any other group. I still think, again, there should be multi-stakeholder liaisons, but not a whole separate team that it needs to get fed to every time. You know, they don't need to send a note up to the periodic review team that says everything looks fine this month. I think it would just be the work of the committee to review performance on a, you know, day-to-day basis and make sure that everything was. The trains were running on time, so to speak. Only when the trains are not running on time would they then feed up to the periodic review team. As it says up there, it's the path of escalation for the IANA customer committee. But if there's nothing to escalate, they don't need to report to the periodic review team. So that's the way I would see it flowing.
So these people are doing it on a voluntary basis, right? All they're going to be paid for it.
Well, I mean, I think they're voluntary as much as anybody is, you know, volunteering. In
this is
Israel.
A daily thing. Okay. Well,
I don't think it would be daily. It's receiving reports. You know, as I assume in many cases somebody is already doing this at many of the TLDs, because, you know, as customers of IANA, they have a vested interest in making sure it's working. So to some extent, this is putting a light framework around an existing set of work that's done. And I wouldn't entirely say it's voluntary, because I assume, I mean, it's not involuntary, but it's part of the probably part of somebody's job description to some extent at, you know, ATLD to be the person who looks at the IANA performance and serves on this committee. So it's not voluntary in the sense that it's a pro bono or something they're doing aside from their day job.
I suppose just one minor supplement to that. Where I think we've added perhaps to this is that what's slightly changed is that, you know, Paul described how he might be looking at these reports on a regular basis, and many others might. What might be a subtle change here is that this group might have a degree of coordination that it otherwise didn't have. And at and when at the coordination level, the group, you know, whether it's just on an email list or some form of coordination, says, hang on, chaps, we all seem to be having a problem here. It's when the escalation component of that customer committee says, hang on, we need to invoke, out of sequence with their periodic reviews, the periodic review team, say, we have an escalation issue here, which is unlikely but perfectly possible, and we need to account for that. Paul, you've been waiting a while.
Thank you very much. So I'm just trying to understand the process going forward. Now, I really think we've made some great advances today. You mentioned the accountability track, and we've put a number of hooks in certainly yesterday's iterations of where that fits in. So in terms of how this scheme works, my understanding is we have to supply a report or whatever it is, our consensus views to this ICG group. And we obviously need to review, I guess, my question is, do we need to review what comes out of the accountability track to make sure that that isn't going to burden this ultra-lightweight body with loads of stuff? Could you just give us a high-level overview of how the process works as you see it?
Try and answer that and see if anyone else has more to add. What we've got going on here is, at a very high level, a recognition that NTIA is pulling out. What we're doing here, if we have a charter which sets out a piece of work we need to do, and that clearly is responding to the ICG RFP. What took place at that point was there was a broad-based recognition that by NTIA pulling out, there was a critical overarching accountability mechanism that ICANN no longer had. In other words, the big sword of NTI hanging over how ICANN did or didn't perform. What was then recognized was that actually there were numerous other concerns in the community about whether ICANN accountability was optimal. And people started to throw all of this into a big bin. And it was then recognized that actually those are legitimate, valid concerns about how ICANN might improve its accountability. But let's pull those out and make that a separate track to that accountability, those accountability issues which were uniquely associated with the removal of the NTIA contract or stewardship function. So there's a narrower component, I believe it's called track one or it's a track that's intimately linked with our work. That group has formed much later than we have, and so we don't know quite what's going to be included there. So at the current time, it's hard to nail down that. But you're right. One of the things that our liaison to that group should do is say, look, for goodness sake, we've done a lot of good work here. Don't disrupt it. You know, by all means, do what you're supposed to do, but be aware of where we've got to. So I think the point is well made, and it's incumbent on the chairs, I guess, to liaise with that newly formed group and explain to them effectively what we've done and make sure that they don't unduly disrupt our progress to date. Malcolm, we've got 3 minutes to go, and I'm conscious I've had three people waiting in the queue for a while, so I'll go to them and then come to you at the end.
Yes, thank you. Malcolm Hattie for the record.
No, I said I'd come to you after.
Oh, sorry,
I've got to defer to the other three in the queue. Thanks, Malcolm. Just that Elise, Matthew, and you're in that queue anyway, so we'll get to you. Elise.
Thank you. That was just a question for clarification. I think we discussed and we kind of concluded that the IANA periodic review teams, let's say decisions or evaluations, should be binding for the contract party to follow up on, right? So it goes to some of the concerns that what happens with the, what are the IANA customer standing committee going to do, you know, like, because they will bring this forward, as I say, to the, as I see it, to this, if they have any worries, they will measure and they will talk and they will get maybe something to bring forward to this periodic review team, which will be acted upon by the contracting party if they make a decision. Is that how we have seen it? So we have like someone who then can have a showstopper or
a slight variation of that is that the contracting entity would delegate to the periodic review team the right to act. So the contracting entity itself wouldn't act,
exactly,
but rather its power to act would be delegated to the periodic review team,
yeah,
which would then go to IANA and say, you know, we have a problem, we're here,
exactly, yeah,
with the power of contract to come and get you to perform.
Yeah, because just I think that clears up some of the discussion and worries about what the different committees have on their plate to deal with and what they're going to do with the advice or the concerns that are raised in these different committees. Thank you.
Very briefly then, if I can have Matthew and Malcolm, and then I think we've hopefully brought the session to a natural close. Go ahead, Matthew.
Yes, Matthew Shears. Thank you, Jonathan, for raising that. That was one of the reasons why I had my hand up. The other was just to make sure that we capture what Malcolm said earlier on, which was with relation to the review team, which there was a possibility that we might actually see a contracting and a performance teams, or I don't know if we captured that. I don't see it up there, though, some skill set or separate groups or something within that. I think that's an important point to capture.
Yeah, that's not being live edited. That's why you're not seeing it there, but I suspect it's in the notes, so we have captured that point. Thanks, Matthew. Malcolm?
Thank you. Malcolm Hutchie for the record. And I would like to say, for the record, that I don't think that everybody in all the communities would completely recognize the description that you gave a few minutes ago about how the relationship between this process and the accountability streams and how they either have come about or indeed what needs to happen going forward. For some, and I'm most familiar with the non-contracted side of the G sector, and I know this view is held by a good number within that among, including myself, there was a perception that at the beginning of this process, ICANN sought to frame this transition process as not being about accountability at all, and said, oh, we'll deal with accountability, but we'll deal with that as a separate thing, and they're just completely delinked. And there is also a perception that there was a considerable strong dissatisfaction in elements of the community with that approach, and an insistence that there were issues of accountability must be tied to this process, and that in recognition, and those that were particularly concerned and particularly vocal about that were very pleased to see it be announced later that the CWG accountability was going to be split into two work streams, with one work stream being explicitly designated as things that must be delivered before transition could happen. And this is being taken by some, I'm not claiming to speak for everyone, but by some, as being a requirement that those issues that are discussed there must be fed in to the transition proposal by some route. So if and since that is that CWG accountability is actually reporting to the ICANN board, the expectation, at least in some quarters, is that the output from CWG accountability, if it has it in time, needs to go in across outside boundaries into this group so that it can be fed up through ICG and out to the NTIA that way, would, as a separate route than just through the via the ICANN board as an internal ICANN matter. Okay, that is a strong expectation in many part of many elements in particularly in that area where I'm talking about.
Okay,
and
so
I suspect there's a degree of I'm detecting a degree of similarity between this expectation and what's being said on behalf of the GAC as well.
So, Malcolm, I don't think that I disagree with anything that you said and didn't mean to say anything that did disagree with it. I think I have a common understanding of the evolution and a common understanding of the outcome. All I meant to express was that there is a technical challenge in meshing those work streams because they are kind of out of sequence. So I agree with you on all of the, as I say, all of the precursory points and where we've got to. I'm just acknowledging that we don't, because the trains have left the station at a different time, we can't currently expect to do any of the meshing, and therefore it's sitting there waiting to happen. And frankly, I'm not quite sure how we will do it, but I don't disagree with you at all.
Well, if we do agree with that and that meshing is needed, I would suggest that we can and should be leaving placeholders in place.
Yes. And I think, to the best of my knowledge, we are. Okay. We're at the time, so I'm keen to draw a line, and I think we've made tremendous progress this morning. It's been great, and we set the scene well last night, so, you know, congratulations to all of you for the really constructive way in which this has worked, and feels like we're in a good place to go and have lunch and take this at this point. What I think we might do, we intend to go into RFP4, but before we do that after lunch, we might look at what Marika's tried to capture, which is a flowchart description of this so that we all can see something which maps out the interrelationships between the entities. Great. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy the lunch. We'll see you back here in 1 hour.